Hello and welcome to Natasha Explains It All. Today's episode is another book review, and today's review is a book called Rest is Resistance by Tricia Hersey, also known as The Nap Ministry on Instagram. And I enjoyed this book as an audiobook experience, and the book is read by Tricia Hersey, which I always recommend when you have the opportunity, right, to actually hear the author read their own work. I just find it such a rich experience. And as the title implies, Rest is Resistance is a critique of how modern society under a capitalist framework really prioritizes productivity over anything else, and how any form of rest, any form of leisure, it can be demonized as laziness, as unproductive, as, you know, not beneficial to society, and how there is a deep need to counter this for not only our own well-being, but also just for our general survival. And there are a lot of modern examples of this that we can see in terms of this. I mean, I think all of us can relate on some level to this idea that we feel like we're measured based on our productivity rather than on, you know, other aspects of our personalities and our contributions, and feeling like we don't have value if we aren't productive. And she talks about how that is a symptom, I guess is a good word, of a capitalist socioeconomic system. And she really challenges us to think about why, how that's become the norm, and why that's the norm, and how we can do different to be healthier. And, you know, she talks about the whole concept of grind culture, which is a symptom of again, a capitalist socioeconomic system that not only prioritizes productivity as the, you know, your greatest value, but almost like, you know, it celebrates and places on a pedestal the concept of grinding, right? Like working really hard is very, very valued in American society. And it's a uniquely American thing. It's not to say that other societies don't, you know, value hard work, but there's very much, just to give an example, you know, there's very much a stereotype of Americans that many foreigners have of, like, you know, when you meet an American and when you meet an American, like the first thing they'll ask you is, what do you do? What do you do for a living? And that's not the, you know, that's not the first question that will come to mind for a lot of people who are not Americans, but it's a very standard American question. And it really speaks to the culture that, like, your value, your definition as a person is so intertwined with your productivity, with your work, and how much that is part of the American ethos. And Tricia does a really a really compelling critique of all of that in a very digestible, quick read on that, and talks about, you know, grind culture as an extension of slavery, and really tying this to the origins of the United States, and talking about how, you know, how you can draw the ties, how you can draw the line, right, starting with slavery and ending at grind culture, is this idea, as she says, of, you know, the worth of bodies being measured by their productivity, by how much they produce. And so talking about the American system and these different, and how it has evolved, that this fundamental idea of productivity, that our bodies are meant to produce, and that is their greatest value, is so embedded in American culture. And that particularly for Black Americans like herself, the resistance part of it, right? How resting, having leisure, having actual rest, having actual sleep is a form of resistance, because for centuries, rest was not allowed, even for things like meal breaks as part of the institution of slavery. And then, you know, talking about then the Industrial Revolution and people working, going to work into the factories, and then, you know, the modern context where we feel like we're on, you know, 24/7. And I just think that there's just, you know, a lot of ideas that she raises that are very thought-provoking. And some of the thoughts for myself, you know, that it brought up, you know, like one of the things she talks about is that, you know, capitalism is new, but our bodies are ancient. And because of that disconnect, you know, capitalism is new and our bodies are ancient, it helps to explain why there is a disconnect, you know, and why for all of the endless news articles and podcasts and programs that are about, you know, how to address fatigue and burnout and, you know, mental health, all of those tend to focus on, you know, what are the things that you can do as an individual, and not realizing the broader structural issues at play that are embedded in the socioeconomic system of capitalism that is just the latest economic system. There have been many systems before, and there will be systems to come. It's, you know, very easy to think that capitalism is the end all be all because it's all we've seen in our lifetimes, but it is just one example. It is just one example of how to organize a society. And with things like the pandemic, we have seen the limitations of such a system and the unsustainability of it, right? Like capitalism is literally unsustainable for the planet because the basis of capitalism is continuous and exponential growth, particularly in the United States, right? Where corporations, which are, you know, the backbone of a capitalist system, are actually legally required to prioritize profit and short-term profit at that, right? Quarter over quarter, they are supposed to produce more and more profit. So constant growth and exponential growth. And that's just unnatural, right? Like that's not how we function as humans, and that's not how the planet functions. The planet, as well as ourselves, are not capable of infinite, indefinite, exponential growth, right? The earth, as well as humans, have fallow periods. We need rest in order to rejuvenate and, you know, to function normally. And so she talks about how unnatural the standards of a modern capitalist system are, and what are ways that we could challenge that. And what I'm about to say, you know, please don't interpret this as me trying to defend feudalism or a peasant lifestyle in the slightest. But again, just as an example, just as a contrasting example of her point about capitalism being just one way of organizing society and the most recent way, and how it's focused, right, on indefinite, infinite, exponential growth is unsustainable and not natural. I saw this, you know, post on social media that was talking about how medieval peasants worked only about 150 days a year. And, you know, the church that had a lot of power at that time, and this is focusing here in Europe, so speaking in the European context, you know, the church believed that it was important to keep, you know, peasants happy with frequent mandatory holidays. And the kind of the punchline of this like meme on social media I saw was that, like, we in the modern era have fewer holidays than a medieval peasant. And I wanted to do a little fact checking of this meme on social media. So I reached out to a friend of mine who is a medieval scholar. She's a historian, and this is like what she studies. And, you know, I showed it to her and wanted to get her thoughts. And, you know, and she, you know, and she agreed with it. You know, she talked about how the, at that time, and again, this is not saying we should go back to these times, but just for the sake of comparison, you know, that, you know, in that time, in the medieval era, you know, peasants, you know, had months off every year. And, you know, they would spend their days off, you know, cooking, mending fences, you know, feeding the animals, you know, working their own fields, right? And not the Lord's fields. But, you know, they definitely had extended periods of time off. And that in comparison, you know, American, modern American work practices basically function like indentured servitude. And, you know, medieval peasants would not stand for modern work standards. You know, they would revolt. And that was her, you know, historical perspective of how at that time, you know, people worked according to the agricultural cycles, you know, and so there is the planting season, and then there is the harvesting season, and then there's the fallow season, you know, during the winter season when you're not planting and you're not cultivating, you know, people rest and instead are, you know, making clothes and, you know, tending to their animals and, you know, doing projects around the house. But there was a more natural rhythm. Following the rhythms of the earth and the seasons, and the fact that the earth has a fallow period every year, and that in some aspects that was healthier for humans. There was more rest built in. Whereas now, with modern agriculture and modern technology and, you know, electricity and cell phones and, you know, remote work and everything, right? We're on 24/7. There is no fallow period. There is none, right? Each year, we ignore that. And to our detriment, again, her point that capitalism is new, but our bodies are ancient. Our bodies have not adapted to the pace of modern society, and that contributes to our lack of health and premature death. And she talks about the story of her own father and him being overworked, and how, you know, she believes that his health issues and his death were related to grind culture, as well as systemic racism and white supremacy, and the built-in narrative of rest as lazy, stemming from, you know, the slavery era and the stereotypes that were built around Black people as being lazy, as not wanting to work hard, but all stemming from this completely perverse environment, right, where they were forced to labor for free under torturous conditions for centuries. And I wanted to, and that context is really important, you know, to be able to critique the modern lens and figure out like what we can do better, you know. And that reminds me of just again, like an example of how the importance of keeping this historical context in mind, which she goes into way more detail about and can explain much better than me. But I mentioned that Trisha runs a business and an Instagram account called The Nap Ministry, where she promotes the importance of rest. And I had received an email from one of these wellness coaches, a wellness coach named Sylvie Caucasian. I don't know if that's how you pronounce her last name, but that's certainly how it's spelled, which is kind of ironic based on what I'm about to say. So I got this email from Sylvie Caucasian talking about the importance of slowing down in the modern modern world and how it's like everything is so fast paced and everything is just like go harder, 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 work harder, 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 you know, produce more, 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 more. And that's all good, right? And like consistent with what we've been talking about and how social media plays into that and how we really need to actively resist that to be able to find peace and to find calm and the importance of finding rest and peace and just doing nothing. And she made reference to the nap ministry. And what she said was that, quote, surrendering to spaciousness and rest is an act of resistance towards the collective agenda. Spaciousness in a sea of productivity is a value worth fighting for. The nap ministry is one of my favorite pages on social media. Their message is entirely dedicated to supporting people to take naps daily as a way to resist the world's fast-moving agenda. I fully and wholeheartedly stand by their message, close quote. And I ended up sending an email, to this wellness person, polite. I didn't hear back, but I wasn't necessarily expecting to, you know. That was like, you know, I'm glad that you are promoting the NAP ministry and the work that they are doing to try to challenge this internalized narrative that, you know, we've all been indoctrinated with, that like we are only as valuable as how much we produce. But her promotion of the NAP ministry was completely divorced from like the reality of what the NAP ministry does. And then NAP ministry is not just about promoting naps. It's about challenging white supremacy and promoting Black liberation. It is about rest as resistance. And it's important to not whitewash that message by just saying that it's a way of like, yeah, quote, resisting the world's fast-moving agenda or, quote, the collective agenda. It's a capitalist agenda. And it's important to name these things so we know what it is that we need to challenge, what it is that we need to do better about. And so, again, understanding the historical roots of why is it that we need to challenge this and why this is not normal, because enslaving other people is not normal. And grind culture is not normal. It's become normalized, but it's not normal because our bodies were not meant to work that way. And the planet is certainly not meant to work that way. And yet we've created so many aspects of our lives in the United States that, that emphasize that, right? For example, just a couple of other examples, like recently there, in the United States, there's been like this whole debacle about raising the debt ceiling, basically the amount, of money, like the amount of money that the U.S. is like allowed to hold in debt. And Republicans were using that, their majority in the House, to be able to use that as a way to leverage some political points that they wanted to push through, basically ready to allow the U.S. to default on its debt and cause like catastrophic worldwide economic damage to make a point. Anyway, the crisis was averted. The president was able to negotiate something with these extreme Republicans. But one of the things that Republicans insisted on, which feeds into this grind culture, was insisting on stricter work requirements for people who receive food stamps and TANF, which are emergency food, they're emergency programs. And there are programs for people who are extremely low income to cover basic necessities, right? Food stamps is for people to buy food, right? So that they don't go hungry. It's one of the most effective anti-poverty measures. There's tons of data on how effective food stamps are. They are a win-win for the economy. I think one study I saw that was saying, you know, for every dollar you spend on food stamps, it generates $1.70 into the economy. because that money is immediately put into the local economy, right? It's spent in grocery stores, and it's used explicitly for people to be able to buy food. Anyway, it's a very effective anti-poverty program. And anyway, one of the things that the Republicans insisted in this debt ceiling standoff that they artificial problem that they created, because normally just the debt ceiling is increased without question, is increasing work requirements for poor people, because they want to make it harder for people to be able to not starve and not go hungry. And based on this narrative of people being undeserving, and that you have to work to deserve food, you know, rather than like this concept of like, you know, people, we shouldn't let people starve in this country, and food stamps are a way of closing that gap. But, you know, it's just a very common talking point on the right to demonize the poor as if, you know, being poor is a basis, therefore, to exclude you further from society. And another related example that we've seen particularly come to light with the pandemic is that, unlike, you know, most of the developed world, for lack of a better term, you know, countries that the United States considers its peers, the United States is the only country where your health care is tied to your employment. So basically, your productivity determines whether or not you have access to healthcare. There is no right to healthcare in this country. You have to work in order to get access to healthcare. And even then, like the irony of that is, right, like if you get laid off, or God forbid, you're in a horrific car accident, or you're diagnosed with cancer, or something else horrible happens, or there's a global pandemic and you're laid off, and you're not working, well, then you lose your health insurance at the very moment where you most need it. And there were some really powerful statistics that circulated during the pandemic about how, you know, when the pandemic struck, millions and millions of Americans lost their health insurance. And nobody lost access to healthcare in what are considered peer countries, like many European countries, Australia, Japan, and, you know, even places like Brazil that actually has a universal healthcare system, it's, you know, has many problems, but like that still exists, Canada, etc. And so the fact that healthcare remains tied to your employment is an example of this capitalist mentality that defines us solely on the basis of our productivity, and how unnatural that is, and how it's not the only way, right? Her point being, right, this isn't the only way to organize society, because many other countries right now have figured out other ways to organize this. We don't say that your access to healthcare is tied to your employment. And, you know, someone might ask, like, or I remember like a Brazilian friend of mine had asked, like, you know, this doesn't make sense even from a corporate perspective, because one of the largest expenses that employers have is funding employee healthcare plans. Like, why wouldn't corporations, who have so much say in American politics, why wouldn't they support having a universal healthcare system so that they don't have to offer that? They don't have to take on that expense. And I don't know the actual reason, but my hunch is that because it serves their ultimate interest of keeping people tied to the jobs. How many people stay at their jobs simply to hold on to their healthcare benefits? You know, even if it's a toxic workplace, even if they're underpaid, even if it's not a good place for them, they're too afraid to lose their healthcare benefits. And so it's leverage. It's power over the employees. It's a way to keep employees subdued. It's a way to keep employees submissive. It's a way of creating control over the employee pool. And so that's why corporations don't support, you know, a universal healthcare system. So, you know, that seems to be another example of the organization and the unnaturalness of a, you know, of a capitalist, framework. And another example, contrasting other countries with the U.S., for example, this is just an example here of, in Europe, for example, and Brazil, for that matter, and many other countries, there's no, when you go to a restaurant, you know, or a coffee shop or something like that, there's no tipping, or little tipping is common. And so you can sit and stay at a table for a long time. There is more of a built-in culture of rest, in the sense of, like, you can take your time over meals. You can sit there and talk with your friends or family and really enjoy that process. In the United States, like, it's almost a joke, right? That it's like, you know, the restaurant's got to turn tables super fast. So, like, the minute you are done with your food, like, that check, they're going to bring the check to you, right? And it's going to be there on the table. And they're going to be like, take your time. But you know that you, like, actually can't take your time. You know, they got to, like, turn tables. Whereas in, like, Europe or places like Brazil, like, it would be rude if the waiter came and brought your bill before you asked for it. And, you know, I mean, the reason for this is based on how staff are paid. In addition to the fact that in these countries, people's healthcare is not tied to their employment. In these other countries, like, people are just paid a salary. They're not dependent on their tips for their income. Whereas in the United States, you know, the servers are dependent on your tips to make an income. It's legal in the United States to pay servers a sub-minimum wage, which is often like $2 to $3 an hour, on the assumption that they'll make up the rest in tips. And so there's this massive incentive to turn tables as quickly as possible, because that's how they make a living. Whereas in other countries where they're just a set salary, like, there isn't an incentive to, like, kick you out the door as soon as possible, because, you know, their salary will be the same, you know, regardless of how long you stay. And I know that there are pros and cons, you know, to both systems. So I'm not issuing a final verdict here. But I'm just wondering if this example, and if the U.S. were to adopt, you know, a restaurant culture that was more similar to many other countries, if that would help us get to a more restful state, right? If we change the way that restaurant workers are paid, would that help shape American culture to not be so grind oriented and allow us more time for rest in the form of, you know, simply sitting and talking and enjoying a meal with people that we really, you know, that we whose company we really enjoy. So, and, you know, in reading this book again, Rest is Resistance, that was just one thing that came to mind of, like, you know, is that one way that we could do something to create more slowness in our culture, you know? Because, you know, another example that she shares is things like social media breaks, which I think generally people would agree are good for us. And she makes the point too that, like, even if what you are consuming on social media is generally positive content, it can still be detrimental. Because it is all about, the algorithms are all designed to take your attention, to hold your attention as long as possible, right? They're fighting for your attention, because the longer you're on there, the more time they have to send you targeted ads, and then the more likely you are to purchase something, right? And she talks about taking breaks as a way of creating rest in our lives. So that's another example that she shares. And the creating a different restaurant culture. I don't know, that reminded me of that, of, like, how could we create more spaces for rest, you know, in kind of everyday activities. To provide a few more examples comparing the United States to other countries that Rust as Resistance reminded me of, one is, I remember listening to this podcast recently by an Australian podcaster, and she was lamenting the fact that in Australia, the standard is, quote, only, close quote, 4 weeks of vacation per year. And she was lamenting the fact that this didn't allow enough time for actual rest and creativity and other things. And one, I didn't know this about Australia, and I did know this about Europe and places like many countries in Europe, Brazil. There are other parts of the world where this is standard, having a month of vacation as the standard across the board. And it was so interesting to me to hear this person, this Australian podcaster, talking about that as insufficient to create, you know, a healthy, balanced lifestyle. And I mean, I had to just like reflect on the fact that, like, you know, I mean, the United States is notorious on this point for how little vacation we have in comparison to the rest of the world. Like, 2 weeks is kind of standard, but some places don't even have that. And I mean, it varies a lot. Like, some, you know, some tech companies and other organizations have, you know, moved to an unlimited PTO model, and some people like actually get substantial time off. But generally, like across the board, people, if they're lucky, will get 2 weeks of vacation per year in the United States. And that is really low in comparison to other countries. And how this is just another example, right, of how rest is actually resistance in the United States, because we built into the American work model is so little rest, right? And certainly if we compare that to countries that the US would consider its peers, of how little vacation we have in comparison to those countries. And other forms of rest, in addition to vacation, for example, well, this wouldn't necessarily, I don't want to necessarily say this is rest, but because this is a very active thing, but like, we don't have like paid parental leave in the United States. There is no federal paid guaranteed parental leave. Like, there is FMLA, Family Medical, like Family Medical Leave Act, but like, we don't have guaranteed paid parental leave like our peer countries do. In Canada, I believe it's a year. In many European countries, it's even more than that. Like, we don't give people time off to be able to attend to their family duties. As another example, like, many people don't even have paid sick time, right? Like, they can't even afford to be sick, because if they're sick, they lose their job, or at the very least lose hours, which means losing income. And that's just not the norm in a lot of other countries. Like, that's, you know, protected by law, that you are entitled to a certain number of sick days because you're human. whereas that is not the norm, you know, in the United States. And as another example, this comes from France, and this is an example of like the evolution and even my own thinking about these things. I spent some time working in France in education and public schools, and I learned that in France, like, all levels of education are covered, you know, through taxes. That all levels of education, not just K through 12, but higher education as well. And I remember thinking at the time, again, based on my American viewpoint, that like, oh, this didn't seem quite right, because then people are going to take their, education for granted. Like, you should have to pay some, because that means you'll value it more, and whatever. And my thinking has evolved on that, particularly in the modern context, given that higher education in the United States is astronomical, astronomical, and just completely outside the bounds of what it costs to go to college in, again, peer countries. And the fact that in the modern context, there are generations of people who will have student debt for decades, decades and decades, paying off college loans. And the fact that even the tiny reforms that the Biden administration is trying to implement to relieve some of that debt is being faced with massive opposition by the Republican Party, who doesn't want to see any student debt relief, again, based on this false narrative that, I don't know, that these people are undeserving, and that, you should, well, if you just, just get a job, and if you can, you should pay off your debt just like everyone else. This just a very grind culture perspective that completely ignores the historical context as well of just how astronomically expensive higher education has become in the last several decades, because the US government has consistently cut its contributions to the cost of higher education. Like, the federal government, you through ta through taxes, used to subsidize higher education at levels that are unheard of nowadays. And so college was much more affordable, not just in like actual dollars, but in relative dollars, right? Like, if we were to adjust for inflation, whatever, the equivalent cost nowadays and then, like, it's so much more now than it used to be. And the federal government actually, and you can research this, actually really started that trend of defunding higher education during the Reagan administration. And a lot of that was based on like very classist and racist notions that he held about not wanting a diverse student population, not wanting a diverse working class educated population. And so, starting with the Reagan administration, that is when we started to see massive cuts to funding for higher education, leading us to the astronomical cost that we have nowadays. And anyway, so just this example from France as well, that again, it is not explicitly an example of rest, but these essential things like, right, sick leave, like parental leave, like higher education, if we remove the financial stress of those things from people, through our tax system and providing that as a social safety net for people, removing the stress of the financial burden of those things allows people to be much healthier, right? We want to encourage people to have families and to take care of their families. We want people to not get sick, and we want people to be educated. I mean, I think, right? Clearly, there are a lot of people who don't feel that way, and that's why they support policies that don't promote those things. But I just wanted to give those a couple of other contrasting examples to kind of expand this idea of rest and how the American system really does not promote rest, because we have to hustle to pay for everything, everything. And it's something that, like, sometimes, or there can be a critique from Europeans where taxes are very high, that they might, certainly it is a view that the taxes are too high here and, the United States is better because taxes are much lower. And yet there is a massive trade-off there because in those countries where the taxes are higher, I'm not saying that the taxes are used perfectly, okay? But there, the taxes then go to pay for the education system, to have a universal healthcare system, to pay for paid parental leave, to pay for paid sick leave that's not tied to your employment, right? You get something out of it. Whereas in the United States, you have to pay for all of that stuff out of pocket. And what's the quality that we get from it and how unequal, right, is that when people have to pay out of their own pocket rather than having it as a universal system? And, there could also be pushback that Natasha, that sounds really great. And I'm hearing you on these different ways that we could incorporate more rest into the American system. In terms of changing habits, in terms of funding certain things so people don't feel so much financial pressure and that they can lead healthier lives. But is this realistic? How are we going to pay for all this stuff? That could be its own series, but just kind of three quick points. One is, as I've been highlighting, other countries do it. Other countries that the United States considers its peers. So there are models out there. There are examples we can look at. This is not impossible to do. And not saying that those countries are perfect, but there are models and there are examples of how we could do better. The second point is we could definitely have a more equitable tax system so that we can actually pay for things like universal pre-K, paid family leave, paid sick leave, higher education, et cetera, a universal healthcare system, et cetera. We could have a more equitable tax system. We could tax the ultra rich. We could tax corporations in a more fair and just way. Just as in a recent example, during the Trump administration, the Trump administration cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, from 35% to 21%. Even at a time of record profits. And even then, we've all heard the reports, or I shouldn't say we've all heard the reports. Many of you may have heard reports about how even that, even slashing the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%, many of the largest corporations don't even pay that. And they're paying little to nothing in taxes, even though they have billions upon billions in profit. We can pay for this stuff. We could absolutely pay for this stuff if we had a more just tax system. I'll just leave it at that. We could talk a lot more about that. And the final point is that programs like food stamps and programs like universal basic income programs. And a universal basic income program is the idea that everybody gets a certain dollar amount as a basic income. And there's lots of different cities and places that have experimented with this, including Stockton, California. So if you want to look up the Stockton, California experiment with UBI, that's a great example to look at. Anyway, my point is that anti-poverty programs like food stamps and UBI, which redistribute financial resources to low-income people, actually boost productivity, actually make it more likely that people can find jobs and keep jobs, which then means that they're paying more taxes, that they are making more money and therefore paying more taxes and all of that jazz. And the reason for that makes sense. Right? If you are in survival mode and you don't have stable housing, you don't have stable food and all that kind of stuff, that's going to be your priority. It's very difficult to find and hold down a job when you're in that space. If you don't have regular food and you're food insecure, you're more likely to get sick, which means you're more likely to miss work, right? Because you're sick and you may be at a
you know, lower income jobs where, again, like missing a day of work may cost you the job because there is no paid sick leave. And with programs like UBI, again, that give low income, I mean, depending on the model, but the idea being that like there is a set amount of money that everybody gets as a baseline, those have been proven really effective as well. Because imagine, like, if you're homeless, well, then you don't have an address to put on like a job application. If you can't afford a cell phone, then you don't have a number to like get to have your interviews and get callbacks. You know, being able to pay for internet access, being able to pay for clothes, right? Like clothes, appropriate clothes for you to go to an interview. Having some income to create some stability in people's life actually makes it easier, right, for them to find and hold down work, because there is enough stability there for them to then be able to have those logistics taken care of, like clothing, etc. But another logistics, like transportation, to be able to like pay for the transportation to get to and from work, to get to and from the job interview, you know, etc. There's some real practicality there. So this is just a couple of points of like, well, how do we pay for this? Well, you know, one, other countries do it, so we can figure out something. Two, we could have a much more equitable tax system. And three, like actually these programs, which, you know, help put money into the hands of low income people, actually boost productivity, actually make it more likely that people are able to, find and keep work. So there are ways. There are definitely ways to make rest a more integrated part of, you know, American society.
So a couple more thoughts before I wrap up. In the book, Trisha talks about, as part of what rest looks like, is like just actual sleep as well. And how sleep deprivation is a really widespread issue. And speaking particularly in the United States. And, you know, that reminded me of how like sleep deprivation itself is a form of torture. Like, it is a tool that interrogators use to break down suspects. Like, this is an actual interrogation tactic that is considered torture. If you deprive someone of sleep over a long enough period of time, like, people start having delusions, right? Like, people get completely disoriented, people break down. It is a form of psychological torture. And so her discussion about the importance of rest as resistance for our survival and our well-being is also connected to this idea that sleep deprivation, which we are, our culture promotes, right? And even celebrates, like, how many times people like brag about pulling all-nighters, right? Whether it's in college or otherwise, as if it's like a mark of, or like a badge of honor, right? Rather than being like a sign of something gone very wrong, right? Like, we need rest. And so anyway, that just reminded me of, you know, like, it's like actually definitionally a form of torture, prolonged sleep deprivation. And then how it also affects brain development. Like, there's studies out there that talk about how people can't be, quote unquote, as smart as they otherwise would be if they're chronically exhausted. And I mean, just think about this on like a very small scale in your own life. When you're feeling tired, right? Like, you just can't think straight. You're not on point. When you're really tired, you just can't think as clearly. You're not on your, you know, you're not at your best. And when this is done on a chronic basis, this can actually change your brain development and actually make it so that
like your intellectual and mental capacities are just not the same if you have experienced chronic exhaustion and chronic sleep deprivation. And, you know, and so what kinds of class and societal differences are we reinforcing by depriving, certain classes and groups of people of adequate rest and adequate sleep, you know, because they have to work so many hours to even scrape by, right? Because as we talked about, or at least I alluded to, in the United States, like even if you work full time, that is often not enough for you to meet your basic needs. And so a lot of people are working multiple jobs just to be able to pay rent, just to be able to put food on the table. And this chronic exhaustion and this chronic sleep deprivation can lead to many health problems, including related to brain development. And, you know, I had read something as well about how people who work in, like as domestic servants in various parts of the world, even though they work extremely long hours, we all want leisure and we all need time for ourselves. And so even after extremely long shifts, they are still likely to stay up even longer, even if it means sleeping much less, so that they have some time for leisure, right? To watch TV, to spend time with their family, to do whatever. And, you know, this reminded me of kind of a personal story. So in Brazil, having domestic servants is still very common. And one of my family members has a driver slash, you know, kind of all hands man. And he does this. Like he works, you know, easily 12 to 14 hour days, easily. And yet, like, you know, when he goes home, like he doesn't, you know, immediately go to bed. Like he still spends time with his family or watches TV shows or, you know, does other stuff, because it's really important to still have time for yourself. And it reminded me of, in the book, Trisha shares this example of her own father, even though he was also working multiple jobs to support the family and also because he felt like he had to. And he also faced a lot of racial discrimination in the workplace. And so he felt the pressure to work harder to be able to get anywhere in the workplace. And she talks about how her dad would get up early in the morning before everyone else to read the paper and to read the Bible by himself before work, just so that he would have some time for himself. And we all need that, right? And you know, the modern work structure is like our best hours, and our, you know, our most of our waking hours are dedicated to earning a paycheck, rather than anything else. And how this not only leaves us chronically exhausted, but also limits our, as I mentioned, brain capacity, including our creative potential, you know, which reminds me of a conversation I had with a relative, and I was just making this point about how, like, you know, a lot of the philosophers that are very well regarded in American culture and generally Western culture, you know, a lot of these, they're all men, you know, they lived at a time and they were of such a social class that, you know, women and enslaved people were doing all the work. Like they had the time and the money and the space to just like sit around and philosophize all day and to think and to tinker and to experiment and to talk with other philosophers and, you know, to participate in society. And, you know, I remember this relative of mine got kind of like mad, you know, about what I was saying, as if I was like undermining their accomplishments, which wasn't my point. I was just pointing out the fact, first of all, And second of all, just like, you know, how much talent, how much creativity, how many philosophers, you know, how many scientists, how many artists have, you know, been deprived of the opportunity to tap into their talent and to share that with the world. You know, how many great minds have been lost and are lost simply because they've been too tired, right, to think the thoughts. Like sometimes, you know, like we need space, we need boredom, we need nothingness, we need no distractions sometimes to have like to have inspiration, right? You know, like I remember one time I saw this sign that said, it was in Spanish, so it said, "Descansa para que veas más claro tu camino." And it was basically like, rest so that you can see your path more clearly. And that really resonated with me, and I hope it resonates with you too, right? That like sometimes when you're just, you know, like you're just overwhelmed or, you know, just not thinking clearly or something's really bothering you or frustrating you, having a good night's rest, you know, or going for a walk, or gardening or something, like can just do wonders for you, right? Like you come back and like the ideas come, like the solutions come. You just have this clarity, right, that you didn't have before. And it's also kind of like that analogy about like, what is it, the lotus flower, you know, grows out of like the muddiest of waters or whatever. I think it's the analogy is more like, you know, you need still water, whatever. I'm butchering that last metaphor. But the point being that how much of our own creativity, how much of our own curiosity and artistic, you know, talents and philosophical insights are we losing out on simply because we're too tired, because we're too exhausted, because we're grinding so much, because, you know, we live in a culture that has said that you don't deserve, I mean, you don't deserve food, you don't deserve healthcare, you don't really deserve anything if you're not working. And you have to be working really hard. And, you know, I think there's just, it's just worth asking some questions about that. And this book, Rest is Resistance, helps raise some of those questions and do some reflection on, you know, how can we create a healthier society and therefore a healthier planet and therefore make our lives more sustainable and more just as a result. So lots of kind of scattered thoughts there, you know, but I hope that that gives you some food for thought. And I will leave it there. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. And that helps more people find out about the podcast. You can also support the podcast financially. There's a link in every episode. And please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to the podcast on. You can also leave me a voicemail. Let me know your thoughts. I'd really be interested in listener feedback. So thanks again for listening. Until next time.